I'm Willow Belden, and you're listening to Out There. This is a podcast that explores big questions through intimate stories in the great outdoors. On this episode, we have a story about love and fear and rock climbing. The story takes us from the windswept prairie of Wyoming to the towering cliffs of Colorado and Utah. It's a story about pushing yourself to overcome your fears. And ultimately, it's about what happens when you don't share your partner's obsession. I'll let writer Stacy McKenna take it from here.
So I've got a confession. It's the kind of thing I simultaneously want to tell everybody and nobody. And I should say most of the time I tell nobody. But I'm going to tell you. The confession is this. I climb because my husband climbs. It's kind of embarrassing, right? We met, we fell in love. He was really into rock climbing, I wasn't. And now, for the past 9 years, I've been doing this sport for him. Funny enough, climbing could have ended our relationship right when it was really getting going. Mike and I met in 2000. We were in Rawlins, Wyoming, this small highway town in the bleak and blustery sagebrush desert. It's one of those places where the wind rips doors right off their hinges and local bars double as drive-thru liquor stores. Two of the biggest employers in the area are a prison and an oil refinery. It's not really the kind of place where young people go to find romance. But it's got the kind of gruff hospitality and individualist sense of community that cracks open a world of surprises. I'd been living abroad before I got to Rawlins, 6 months caring for horses in Austria, and 9 months failing miserably at nursing school in Montreal. And I had a serious hankering for some wide open landscapes, the kind you find in the American West, where clouds cast shadows and you have to squint to see the horizon. Anyway, I had landed this summer job with the Bureau of Land Management, so I showed up in Rawlins just before dawn on a chilly morning in late April. On a Greyhound bus, because, of course, I didn't have a car. I went for coffee at the only spot that was open, a diner with deer and pronghorn heads all over the walls, and a pamphlet that said something about getting frostbite because of the wind chill factor. I was totally, utterly culture shocked. I guess it makes sense that that's how our relationship started. During my first couple weeks in Wyoming, I got settled into the job and the government digs. We had dorms of sorts in these aging trailers littered with mouse droppings. I worked on a resources team, which meant I helped pretty much all of the departments, including my favorite, archaeology. But most of my time was actually spent building fences. Mike was working wildfire. We first met when he taught my crew how to put snow chains on our tires. Yep, snow chains. In April. I think they were for mud, but still. Mike had this scruffy beard and his cheek bulged with chewing tobacco. He was so not what I thought my type was, but he had a wicked smile and sparkling blue eyes and shoulders built to wield axes, and I could not stop thinking about him for days. He lived up at the employee barracks, too. But since the men's accommodations were worse off than the women's, he voluntarily slept in his beat-up truck. Apparently, he liked my overalls, and the fact that I'd drink my whiskey neat or on the rocks. I liked that he didn't flinch at my vegetarianism, that he snagged bites of tofu from my bowl. Anyway, we met and shared this incredible summer in Rawlins that involved a lot of drinking, outdoor concerts, and talking until the sun came up. It wasn't long before I took up residence in his truck. Mike told me so many stories about his climbing adventures that I wanted flashcards to get the vocabulary down. I rattled on about politics and public health and my recent decision to make the U.S. my long-term home. Suddenly, it was early August, and time for me to head to Cleveland for grad school. The weekend I was supposed to leave, Mike was sent on a 2-week fire deployment. So we said our frantic goodbyes, and I took the bus to the train to my new life. I don't know if either of us really believed a long-distance relationship could work, but we figured why not give it a try. By the time I moved to Colorado in the late spring of 2000, Mike and I had been together for almost a year. But most of our relationship had taken place over the phone, meaning we knew each other, but also we really, really didn't. He swears that knowing me the way he does now, he would never have introduced me to climbing the way he did. To understand what happens next in our story, there are three things you have to know about me. One is that I have a really intense fear of heights. Like, really intense. I'm that girl who can't even appreciate the view of Paris from the Eiffel Tower without slinking away from the edge. I'm also not the most trusting. I trust horses and my dog. I kind of trust myself, and I've learned to trust Mike. But other than that, I tend to assume that things will break and people will make mistakes. The third thing you have to know about me is that I'm really self-conscious. Which means, regardless of how good I get at something, I hate being watched. And I especially hate being watched when I'm first learning how to do something, which means I hate learning and failing in public. But that first time Mike took me climbing, he didn't know any of those things. And I didn't even realize the extent of them. We went to Garden of the Gods, a cluster of orange and white sandstone formations in Colorado Springs. Gorgeous domes and fins and spires seemed to just rise out of this emerald sea of willows and junipers. This is where Mike had cut his own climbing teeth more than a decade before. And it's a good place for a beginner. It has easy approaches and lots of beautiful, moderate climbs. The catch is that most of these accessible starter routes sit right in the middle of tourist land. The park is threaded with paved paths that wind around the rock formations, and throngs of tourists meander the area pretty much all day, every day. They even have Segway tours. So as we hucked our packs full of harnesses, shoes, ropes, and gear onto our backs and started toward the crags, it became increasingly clear that people would be watching the whole time. Lots of people. Still, even though there were butterflies in my stomach, I was curious, excited even. When we got to the base of the white twin spire, Mike set up a top rope on a beginner route. He helped me tie the rope to my harness and explain some key concepts. He told me that the rope stretches a little, meaning that when I put my full weight on it, I'd sink a few feet, but I wasn't falling. He told me how to position myself once I got to the top of the climb so that he could lower me gently back to the ground with the rope. He explained that my feet were way more important than my hands. And most importantly, he said that all that mattered was having fun. Nobody cared if I got to the top. I've since learned that Mike is actually a really thoughtful and thorough climbing instructor. But that day, something didn't connect. The first few minutes went okay. I put on my climbing shoes and started making my way up the rock. But then, about 30 feet up, I started to freak. I was on a thin spire, which means there's lots of exposure. I looked left and saw air. I looked right and saw air. I looked in front of me at the purplish rope that was supposed to catch me if I fell, and I thought, how on earth can this thing hold a body? That was the moment when my fear of heights kicked in. Like, really kicked in. I realized I hadn't understood the extent of my phobia before. But now, I realized just how powerful it was. This wasn't the standard survival-driven anxiety you get from being several stories high. This was a paralyzing panic. My breath caught somewhere in my throat, which left me desperately choking on air. My arms went numb from fingertips to shoulders, which is not the most confidence-inspiring feeling when trying to hang on for dear life. My guts quaked and my mouth went dry as the surge of adrenaline readied my body for fight or for flight. And suddenly, my thoughts were consumed with everything that could go wrong. The rope could fail, my knot could come untied, the anchor carabiners could open. I even imagined the bolts pulling clear out of the rock. Every creak my knot made sounded like something snapping. The world seemed to be whirling around me, and I pictured myself hurtling toward the earth. Mike told me to sit back in my harness, but I was so scared that I ignored him, instead clinging to that delicate rock as my breath caught and my limbs trembled. I shouted down to him, "I don't know what to do! I don't think the rope is going to hold me! What if I'm stuck up here?" "Just sit back in your harness," came his calm, would-be soothing response. "No!" I screamed. Just as I started to cry, I heard the sound of shutters clicking. 30 feet below, tourists were snapping pictures, immortalizing my breakdown. My cheeks blazed as embarrassment amplified my fear and simmered its way toward anger. I wasn't just scared anymore. I was pissed. At Mike for his gentle encouragement from below and for his love of this awful sport. At myself for failing in front of all these people and blubbering for their cameras so they could laugh at me every time they cracked the family photo album. And at these strangers who were apparently oblivious to my humiliation. Or maybe they were reveling in it. I should have listened to Mike's pleas to sit back in my harness and wait the rope. Instead, I ignored him and clung to the wall as my body shook. I stayed that way for what felt like an hour, but could have been anywhere between 5 and 20 minutes, until eventually the anger snapped me out of the fear paralysis. Finally, my head cleared a little, and I pulled from a well of instincts ingrained during a lifetime of riding horses. I've been a rider for as long as I can remember, and spent much of my youth guiding horses over jumps I could barely see over the top of. Riding is a sport with a danger quotient on par with motorcycle racing. And if there is any rule that applies to all equestrian sports, it's that no matter how many times you take a fall, you get back on. If you don't, the fear just eats away at you. And so now, still clinging to the rock, I wiped my snotty, tear-streaked face on my shoulder and called down to Mike. "I'm gonna keep climbing." He said I didn't have to, that he could lower me. I didn't appreciate that at the time, but I've since seen more dudes than I can count holler at their panicked girlfriends to keep going. I always wonder whether they ever tried again. I think if Mike hadn't given me the space to decide for myself, that may have been my last climb. As I started back up the wall, I sang to myself. Think I'm going for a walk now. Feel a little unsteady. Don't want nobody to follow me, except maybe you. Since I was a teenager, I've used the rhythm of Ani DeFranco's Untouchable Face to calm anxious thoroughbreds. That afternoon, I learned that it settles my nerves, too. Once I started moving again, I finished the final 10 feet or so in bursts. When I got to the anchor, I clenched the rope with both hands right above the knot, you know, just in case it came untied or something, and sat back in my harness. The people who were watching from below whooped and applauded. Mike lowered me to the ground and let me tuck into the shelter of his towering torso as I gasped for air and fought the urge to crumple into tears again. He climbed the route to remove his gear that was serving as our anchor, rappelled off, and we packed up to leave. I kept apologizing for my freakout and my fear. "I can't do it again today," I said shakily as we shuffled out of the park. "Of course not," Mike said. "You don't ever have to climb again if you don't want to. But if you do, we'll go to the gym. It'll feel safer." To this day, I don't really know what got me to give climbing another try. Mike wanted me to, but he never pressured me. Part of it was probably that I had this urge to share. I wanted to know something intimately that he loved so much. But it was also, maybe ironically, about that ingrained horse girl response to failure. Get back on. Don't let fear keep you back. I know that's what drove me to finish that first ever route at Garden of the Gods, even after my panic set in. And while I didn't climb anything else that day, that decision to finish left me open to try again. The second time we took a different approach, one that would set me up to learn to manage my body and my fear in a more controlled environment. We went to the climbing gym. And it was there, climbing up the colorful plastic holds on the fake rock wall, that I started to manage the fear. I got used to things like the sound of a knot tightening or the rope stretching. I learned to trust my harness. And I was able to practice without all the tourists gaping at me. But I still got scared. I was figuring out how to handle my fear of heights, but it's not like it went away. Most new climbers spend their first months with the goal of gradually upping the difficulty of routes they can finish. But I just wanted every outing to be less frightening. One day, Mike asked me, what was I so scared of, specifically? And I had to admit that it wasn't just about the height itself. I was scared of the gear failing. I'd tumbled down these wormholes of knots coming untied, harness straps unraveling, ropes snapping, anchors pulling out of the wall. And once that started, I couldn't switch it off. That's when Mike's past experiences teaching kids, coupled with his full-on geek love of all things physics, kicked in. Every trip to the gym would start with me just sitting in my harness. At least a couple of times during each session, he'd urge me to outclimb his belay so that there would be extra slack in the rope. Then I had to let go, making my falls a little bigger and a lot scarier. Some days when the gym wasn't crowded, I'd swing on the rope, something way more likely to happen outside. Mike researched the force ratings on all of our equipment, as well as standard gym gear, and he filled my anxious mind with reassuring numbers. As I readied for my practice falls, he'd remind me that everything was rated to catch falls that were way more powerful than what I could generate doing what I was doing. The fear didn't go away, not by any means. Sometimes I still have panic attacks just cleaning the anchor. But as my trust in Mike bled over to a trust in the gear, the very things I'd been most scared of at first became my lifelines, literally and figuratively. Understanding the gear's capacity gave me a concrete way to manage my fear. And practicing that sensation of falling over and over and over again helped reinforce my growing trust in the abstract concepts. I've been climbing for almost a decade now, but even though it's become an integral part of my life, I still don't do it for me. Not in that personal empowerment, hit the crags with the girls, yearn for it when we take a break sense. See? I can't even think about climbing independently. Because the thing is, even after all this time, I still climb because my husband does. It's something we do together. Climbing has been in Mike's life ever since he was a kid. And it'll always be his thing, something close to his heart. And I get what it means to love a sport so much that it's tangled up in your identity. That's how horses always were for me. Even when I'm not riding, I'm a horse girl. I'm an equestrian. It's in my blood. But when it comes to climbing, I'm pretty sure if he quit, or we split, I'd probably leave the sport behind. And that realization, this idea that I don't climb for myself, that I do it for somebody else, it's tough to swallow. It makes me not just question my own motives, but compare myself to others. And sometimes I come out feeling like I'm just an awful feminist. I mean, climbing offers all these amazing opportunities to be a powerful woman, to challenge the idea of what women can do or should do. And there are all these amazing climbing women who blow my mind. So I kind of feel like I'm squandering an opportunity. I mean, here I am, openly admitting that not only did my husband introduce me to the sport, but I probably wouldn't continue if it weren't for him. In fact, about half the time, I have to force myself to hit the gym or fake a smile when we pull up at the crag. Fortunately, it doesn't make me resentful. But it does make me wonder, what would my 16-year-old self say if she saw me doing this for a guy? Why on earth do I keep doing it if I don't love it? There wasn't a specific moment when climbing became part of my life. It just kind of crept in there. Mike and I visited the climbing gym regularly to get strong, and we started incorporating climbing into road trips. That part just sort of happened. But there's one trip, in August of 2008, about a year after that disastrous day in Colorado Springs, when I realized that even if my feelings about the sport are mixed, I'm totally in love with the lifestyle and the places it takes me. I had just started a PhD program and had a week off, so we headed out for 8 days of climbing in Utah and southern Colorado. The climbing was cool. Towering red sandstone in Moab, riverside boulders in Joe's Valley, epically streaked bulges of volcanic tuff in Penitente Canyon. But the trip was amazing. One sweltering afternoon, we stopped to swim in the Colorado River with our water-loving mutt. We munched sandwiches in the shade of a bridge. We spent our one rest day at Glenwood Hot Springs, where Mike wrecked his abs perfecting a 1.5 off the diving board. We played fetch among the continent's tallest sand dunes and slept beneath blankets and blankets and blankets of stars everywhere we went. Suddenly I got it. Sure, climbing can be about pushing grades or high adventure. But for me, for us, it's about interacting with some of the world's most strikingly stunning and humbling landscapes. That trip solidified it. Climbing may not ever be mine, but these trips are ours. And that's the kind of crazy thing. I do love something about it. I just don't love it the way I think others do. Or maybe I don't love it the way I think I'm supposed to. I love climbing for its magical place in my relationship. I love that it makes sure that my marriage is constantly showing me new perspectives. I love that it takes me new places and pushes me way, way, way outside of my comfort zone. And so in the end, it doesn't matter that I climb because my husband climbs. It just matters that I'm doing it and that it makes my life better.
That was Stacy McKenna. She lives in Fort Collins, Colorado, and her writing has appeared in Horse Illustrated, Eon, and 5280 Online, among other places. If you'd like to read more of her work, you can check out her website, stacymckennawrites.com. Coming up on the next episode of Out There, we have a story about someone who doesn't fit the description of the traditional outdoorsman. It's a story about trying to do something you love when you don't look the part.
You know, they're essential tools for birding. They're your binoculars, your spotting scope, your field guide. And if you're black, you're going to need probably two or three forms of ID.
What it's like trying to enjoy and study the outdoors when you're black. That's coming up February 16th on Out There. Thank you to Will Fitzgerald, Ben Staub, Annette Majewski, Kirsty Johansson, Boz Wellborn, and Deb and Vince Garcia for their financial contributions to Out There. If you're enjoying the show and you're in a position to make a donation of your own, please do so. Just go to outthereshow.com and click support. This podcast is on a shoestring budget and every dollar counts. For a donation of $50 or more, we'd be happy to thank you by sending you an Out There t-shirt. That's it for this episode. Special thanks to Andrea Smarden and Caitlin Pierce for production feedback. Andrea hosts a new podcast called Changing Our Stories, and Caitlin produces a show by and for teens called Feeling Some Type of Way. This episode was produced by me, Willow Belden, and our theme music was written by Jared Arnold. Have a beautiful day, be bold, go outside, and find your dreams.